The militant suffragette tactics end with the outbreak of war in 1914, the outbreak of the First World War. Suffrage campaigning does not stop. It continues throughout the First World War, but it takes different formats. You don't have the suffragettes outwardly chaining themselves to statues and railings anymore, but the lobbying continues. Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst think that the best way for women to get the vote is to support the war, and so they advocate for women to join the war effort, believing that this will lead to the vote after the war. Sylvia Pankhurst, another daughter of Emmeline, takes the opposite view, which is that women should be pacifists and resist the war, and she spends the war working for working-class women who were very poverty-stricken by the war in the East End of London. Millicent Fawcett carries on campaigning quietly behind the scenes, writing letters, lobbying, trying to set up meetings, and the chance came when the Speakers' Conference on Electoral Reform was set up in 1916. This was set up not to give votes to women, it was set up to give votes to men and for other electoral reform issues, because 40% of men couldn't vote before 1918, which is something we tend to forget today. And after the war had been going on and many millions of men had gone off to fight and to die, and especially after conscription started and men no longer had any choice over it, it was not possible politically to deny these men the vote, not just the soldiers and the sailors, but also men working in munitions factories and in other areas of industry supporting the war effort. And then the question had to be asked that if all these men were to get the vote for their war effort, what about the women who had also supported the war effort? So it became necessary to at least consider the role of women. I think it's sometimes said that women got the vote as a reward for their war work, and this is not true, because the women that got the vote were women over the age of 30 who met minimum property qualifications. These were not, by any means, the bulk of the women who did the war effort, most of whom were younger than 30, particularly the young women doing the most dangerous work in munitions factories and the hardest work in other factories and on the land. Nor did it include other women working for the war effort who were too poor to qualify for their property qualifications, even if they were over the age of 30. But what is true is that the war made a difference in terms of changing the political atmosphere. It provided an opportunity for many MPs to change their mind, to climb down off their high horses. The situation, by the time you get to the debates in Parliament in 1917, when the Speakers' Conference had recommended that some women should get the vote, was entirely different. And the war gave men such as Asquith, the former Prime Minister, who had been one of the greatest opponents of women's suffrage before the war, the chance to say he had changed his mind, that it was not necessary to go back to pre-war conditions, that he was now willing to support at least some women having the vote. And these arguments won out first in the House of Commons and then in the House of Lords, leading to the passage of the Representation of the People Act in February 1918. So as soon as some women got the vote in February 1918, the next argument was whether women could become MPs. Following various incidents and discussion, an act was passed at the end of 1918 that allowed women to become members of Parliament. This is called the Parliament Qualification of Women Act 1918. The first woman to be elected, Constance Markovitch, never took her seat because she was a member of Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin MPs don't take their seats at Westminster by their political principle. But the following year, in 1919, the first woman was elected who did take her seat at Westminster. Her name was Nancy Astor, and she was elected in a by-election for Plymouth Sutton in November 1919. When Nancy Astor turned up at Westminster, women were still not allowed in various areas of the building. There were large areas of Parliament where women were either formally excluded, banned from, like the smoking room, and other areas such as bars, which women were just not welcome in. The House of Commons chamber, of course, was at the heart of all this. Nancy Astor was perfectly entitled to go in there as a woman MP, but there were many men who did not want to see her there, even if they knew her socially, because she was a well-connected woman who knew most of them socially. They didn't want to see her there doing work in there. They didn't move up to allow her space. She tried to sit in various positions at the end of a row, which would be more convenient for her to get in and out with her large skirts and hat and so on, and they wouldn't move up to let her sit there. They were very rude to her, many of them. Some were sympathetic, but many more weren't. This sort of sets the scene, if you like, for the next 100 years of women in Parliament, because women were only there in really small numbers at the beginning. They're given one room for them all to share, the lady members' room. Nancy Astor has it all to herself at first. Other women are expected to share once they're elected, sort of throughout the interwar years, and indeed throughout the 1950s, 60s, into the 70s. Members of Parliament don't get their own offices automatically for around the 1970s. Men wouldn't have either, but of course men had access to all these other spaces in Parliament that women found difficult to use. Men also had access to many spaces like private clubs out, just immediately outside Parliament, where much business got done and where women were still banned from. And so conditions were very difficult for many of these early women MPs, who were expected to sit on the floor if there weren't enough spare seats in the lady members' room to do their constituency work, or to have meetings sitting on a bench outside in a corridor, again, if there wasn't space in the lady members' room. Some of the women were made a big effort to make their mark in the chamber, even though, again, it was designed for men. It's a very masculine building in Houses of Parliament. The benches in the House of Commons chamber are designed for taller people than many of the early women MPs were. Ellen Wilkinson, one of the earliest Labour women, found her feet didn't touch the floor when she sat on the benches, the green benches in the House of Commons, so she put her bag on the floor so she could balance her feet on her bag. And these sorts of arguments still resonate today. Many things have changed. There are far more women MPs today than there were in that very early interwar period. But we're still a long way off a 50-50 Parliament. And although women are no longer banned from any spaces in Parliament, there are still many women MPs who find it uncomfortable, particularly in the bare pit of the House of Commons chamber when it's full during Prime Minister's questions, for example, or when it's controversial issues are being discussed and it gets very noisy and rowdy. There are still not enough seats for all MPs in Parliament. People still have to stand, shout to be heard, try and catch the Speaker's eye. And although facilities for women MPs are much better than they used to be, there are still a whole host of things that could be done to improve the situation for women today, of which women MPs continue to campaign for. Reports by bodies like the All Party Group on Women in Parliament, a report called The Good Parliament, issued by Sarah Childs a couple of years ago, that issued a whole host of recommendations that would make Parliament a more gender-sensitive space. Most of these still remain to be done.